instead of just reading the passage right straight up, we'll get there in about three slides, and then we'll read the passage then. I wanted to move into kind of a quick review of what we did last week. First, next slide there, Mark. Next slide, please, Mark. So when we date Revelation, it impacts, and I mentioned these things, our current outlook, prospects, our biblical eschatology, and our Christian worldview. And it was brought up to me after we discussed this last time, particularly how it can affect our outlook and our eschatology, that in some way people look at this, they put into place things that have to happen first before Jesus can return, such as rebuilding the temple and these type of things, which means Jesus' words to us, "I can come like a thief anytime," really has no meaning until all that takes place. And that's problematic. And there are people who think in terms of, well, we need to do this and this and this and make sure this happens on the world stage. We need to make sure Israel, you know, can push that mosque off with a bulldozer and rebuild the temple so Jesus can come again. And that's kind of how that particular thought process goes. And there are a lot of people who think these kind of things. It's problematic when we say this must take place before Jesus comes again, because that's not what Jesus said. And I don't know how to put it any clearer than that. Were any other thoughts come to mind on those things? No? Okay, next slide there. All right, so we look at the evidence. Do y'all remember what the evidence was that we mentioned? It was late. What's the evidence that we look at whenever we want to date anything in the Scriptures?
Internal, external, and bibliographical test, isn't it?
You nailed it, Grace. Thanks. Internal and external. The internal, which basically is the self-witness of the text. What does the text tell us about itself where we can identify where it was written based on what it says, kind of thing? And then, of course, the external, which is tradition and other sources. And really, you want to weigh those, because sometimes it's not necessarily very clear in one or the other. And so you look at it and you basically kind of add up the weight. And you kind of say, well, it seems like this may be the stronger. However, the internal witness is always, always stronger than tradition, because it's God's inspired word. And that carries a weight of its own, especially when it's fairly clear on what it's talking about. It's the most important consideration when determining date, the witness of the inspired text, which is kind of what we're going to look at today. Go ahead, next one there, Mark. All right, so Revelation 11, 1 and 2. I'd hoped to get here last week, but I'm glad we didn't, because as I do, I continue to read. And someone somewhere in something I read suggested an article, and I found it and I started reading. I was like, oh, this is real good. It's actually this particular paper here, because I've already told y'all that I hold to the harlot being Jerusalem, not Rome. And this is actually a paper on it. And in the paper, he had to examine the evidence of the date of writing, which was fascinating. It's written by a guy by the name of Reagan Ewing. He wrote it in 2002. And get this, he wrote it at Dallas Theological Seminary, which is the heart of dispensationalism as far as seminaries is concerned. It's funny, Daniel B. Wallace, he wrote this fantastic book that I use regularly in my own studies called Greek Grammar Beyond the Basics. He's a professor out there, and I guess he was one of the readers, and he posted it online because people wanted this. It's so well written. He basically says he and his other reader disagreed with the guy, but it's well written. But, you know, what do you expect? He was at Dallas Theological Seminary. I think Reagan Ewing, who is a pastor, by the way, now, I think he was very bold to write such a paper while he was there. And this is something I would recommend, especially if you're interested in what we're talking about. So that's something I'm going to reference a little bit. That's in addition to, I've mentioned Gentry. I gave you another list last time recently of several different sources. So I'm adding that to it just because it's so good. and we'll mention that later. So Revelation 11, 1 through 2. Then I was given a measuring rod like a staff, and I was told, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship there, but do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it is given over to the nations, and they will trample the holy city for 42 months. Next slide there, Mark. All right, so as you read that, and you might want to keep your Bibles open because we're going to keep referencing this. When you read that, what's the holy city?
Jerusalem,
right? When we all just go, what's a Jerusalem? We just kind of know that, right? Well, why do we know it's Jerusalem? How do we know this? What is that?
It's where the temple is.
Well, yeah, but how do we know which temple? It could, you know, why is he not talking about some temple somewhere else in another city? How do we know it's Jerusalem?
It's been called the holy city.
It has been. Where is it called the holy city? Is it in the Bible?
Yes. Oh,
there you go. Context. So go ahead. Next slide. Next slide. Context. You like that? The words. Okay, so, all right. And we've got a couple of different kinds of context we're looking at here. We're looking at basically the biblical context and the revelation context. In other words, the actual book it is written. And of course, in the Bible, Jerusalem is frequently called the holy city. You see this numerous times. I've got a bunch listed up here. I'll read to you Isaiah 52:1, for example. Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For there shall no more come into you the uncircumcised and unclean. Then Nehemiah 11:1. Now the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9 out of 10 remained in other towns. In Matthew 4:5. Then the devil took him, who's him?
Jesus,
to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple. And notice here are the temple references is there with the holy city. And then Matthew 27:53, the tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. Which had to have really been freaky. Knock, knock, knock. Hey, anybody home? Yes. Oof. Didn't we bury you? That had to have been a real interesting time. But there it is. The holy city, Jerusalem. So Revelation context. So actually Revelation, in this actual chapter, Revelation 11:8, and their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city that symbolically is called Sodom in Egypt. And we'll definitely talk about that, not tonight, but later, where the Lord was crucified. That's pretty specific, right? Where was Jesus crucified? He was crucified in Jerusalem. And I don't think that with this group in particular, we need to dig into the validity of that, but there's several verses that verify that. All right, so next slide there, Mark. So, all right, to what temple is this a reference then? In 11:2?
Temple in Jerusalem.
The temple in Jerusalem. Whose temple?
God's.
Well, it was God's, but then Jesus said, it's your house. Remember in Matthew? It was God's temple, but Jesus abandoned it. So at this point, it's just the Jews' temple, but it had been God's temple. And how do we know? Next slide. Go ahead. It's in Jerusalem. 42-month assault parallels with the Olivet Discourse, time references, the temple is still standing, and number 6, Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed in AD 70. So here's 6 reasons why we know that this is the temple in Jerusalem, which was destroyed in AD 70. That's kind of critical there. Next slide there, Mark. So let's look at it first. It's in Jerusalem. In the reading and the hearing of Revelation, as it was written by John, the audience would have immediately made this connection, especially in context to mention the holy city. Now, why? Because it was written by John. What is it about John that would have made the readers and the hearers think in terms of this is Jerusalem because John, or this was the temple in Jerusalem because John was the author? What is it about John that would have indicated that? He was an apostle, yes. A lot of what he had to say happened in Jerusalem with Jesus, right? That was a big part of the gospel message, which he was apostle for. I mean, he was a Jew. I mean, it was important. This is important to his whole message, the things that happened in Jerusalem. Of course, that's what he's referring to. And the temple, too, was one of the ancient, the ancient wonders of the world. I mean, it was renowned throughout the world. It was one of the most magnificent buildings anywhere, even Tacitus. And Tacitus, you read his stuff, he didn't like Jews or Christians. And he was a contemporary Roman historian, but he did say this about the temple. He said, the temple in Jerusalem is being famous beyond all other works of men. A temple of immense wealth. I mean, famous beyond all other works of men. This is a totally pagan man who was a Roman historian. And that's what he said about the temple. And so, number two there, the temple will be under assault for 42 months. And I just think this is fascinating. Y'all still got that out in front of you? What does it say? I mean, it's going to be under assault for 42 months. Gentry basically points out, he says the 42 months, Revelation 11:2 or 1,260 days, Revelation 11:3, happens to parallel the period of the Jewish war with Rome from the time of its formal engagement by Nero until the temple is destroyed by Titus. Nero ordered Vespasian to march on Israel in February of AD 67. Vespasian had to arrive and engage in battle, and he did that in the spring of AD 67, sometime in the spring. And by the end of August, Jerusalem and the temple had been destroyed. So as Gentry points out, spring AD 67 to August/September AD 70 is a period right around 42 months. Coincidence? Evidence adds up. Evidence really, really, really starts adding up. Next slide there, Mark, please. Can y'all see the color code? Kind of. See, this is in green. This is orange. This is yellow. This is yellow. This is green. And this is orange. I did that to kind of point out to you the similarities between the verses. So the structure of Revelation 11, 1 through 2 parallels and builds upon Jesus' statement in the Olivet Discourse found in Luke 21, 24. So here's those two passages, Luke 21, 24. It says, Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And the word there is ethnon. Comes from ethnos, meaning either nations or Gentiles. And then Revelation 11:2, the court which is without the temple leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. So another form of ethnos. There are three points of contact here in the Olivet Discourse in Luke specifically, and then what Mark says here in Revelation 11. Three points. The reference to the Gentiles, the trampling underfoot, and the city of Jerusalem, basically. Jerusalem, the holy city, that's referred to there. Now, can y'all see how these are referring to the same event? You know, three points of contact, especially considering all the other evidence that I've been talking about over time, about John's apocalypse being John's version of the Olivet Discourse that was recorded in the Synoptic Gospels, not in John. Especially this terminology of the Gentiles trampling Jerusalem. That's huge. What are you saying? And especially when we consider with these time frame. So any thoughts on that? Does that make sense? Y'all tracking on that? Okay. Next slide there, Mark. All right. So time references. Now, I've talked about this a lot, but it's worth mentioning again. The Olivet Discourse. The destruction of the temple is tied to what? To when? To who? When's it going to be done by? This generation that Jesus was talked to then. And we understand generation typically understood about 40 years or so. Alright, so when John, as we're saying in the early date, he was writing in Revelation, he declares that his prophecies must soon take place, Revelation 1:1, because the time is near, Revelation 1:3. Well, if he wrote it in the mid-60s, roughly 35 years or so after Jesus had uttered these words in the Olivet Discourse within a generation, and it was destroyed in AD 70. Does that fit, kind of? It fits exactly, like a glove. it fits. Absolutely. Next slide there, Mark, please. So the temple is still standing. Basically, this order is given, go do this. And the temple is still standing. He wasn't telling them to go to an imaginary temple. There was a temple that he was referring to that was rooted in the holy city with a trampling coming, the time frame of his trampling, and the near-term promise of the prophecy's fulfillment. So we've got several pretty good fits of evidence. It's not just one fits. I mean, several. There's several things here that all fall into place. Again, it's not an imaginary temple that he's told to engage with. It's not symbolic. So again, Reagan Ewing, this master's thesis I was telling you about in Dallas, it's brilliant. And he gives two reasons against a symbolic interpretation of the temple in Revelation 11, 1 through 2. And here's what he says. First of all, John is explicit in the book when it comes to heavenly and earthly realities when it comes to Jerusalem and the temple. That's interesting. He makes a point. John is explicit and makes sure you know the difference when he's talking about one or the other. So he says, in chapter 21, of course, we vividly have the new Jerusalem descending from heaven itself to earth, and John is careful to note that within it there is no temple. There is no temple in the new Jerusalem. So Revelation 21:2, and I saw the holy city, new Jerusalem, coming down out of the heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And then Revelation 21:22, and I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. We get the imagery there, right? It's clear he's not talking about the temple that is in the physical Jerusalem that has still got the Gentiles coming, that's going to and so forth. So, also, similarly, in the very passage in question, chapter 11, we are later given a vision of the heavenly temple. So we have a heavenly temple in contrast to the earthly temple here. In this heavenly temple, it's in which the Ark of the Covenant appears. So Revelation 11:9, the same chapter, Revelation 11, verse 9 there. Then God's temple in heaven was opened, and the Ark of the Covenant was seen within his temple. So notice there, specifically, God's temple in heaven in 11:9. Where before he's talking about the temple in Jerusalem that's going to be trampled by the Gentiles and so on and so forth. There's a definite distinction between the temple in heaven and the temple on earth that's going on here. And this contrasts with the earthly temple, like I said. And so when we look at this, it seems like John was making sure we understand 11:1-2 is referring to a literal earthly temple. And another thing, and y'all may have, we touched on it a little bit when we got started here. The temple in Revelation 11:1-2 is not some temple to be built towards the end of time, which would be utterly meaningless to his audience and fails in several other ways, such as it would not be a true temple of God. It would just be a building they built there. And Ewing, he's well versed in this latter argument, being there at Dallas Theological Seminary. Well, he touches on this too. Now, Ewing, I mean, this guy must be a fascinating man. I mean, he had to have been a total rebel to hold this position and to turn this in to Daniel Wallace, who was a brilliant scholar, and say, here you go. I know you disagree with it, but wow. But this guy is bold. But it's so well argued. I kind of look at him, I'm like, wow, this is so good. But this is what he says. He said, without any informing of a future rebuilding in the text, the author, writing so soon after the Jewish war in a late date paradigm, would have surely confounded his readers. Sure. Also, Gentry, and before Jerusalem fell, he says this, where is there any reference to the rebuilding of the temple in Revelation so that it could be again destroyed? If there is no reference to a rebuilding of the temple, and the book was written about AD 95, how could the readers make sense of its prophecies? Think about that. It was only 25 years later we're talking about. AD 95. And the temple was destroyed in AD 70. And now he's talking about a temple as if it is still existing. It doesn't make any sense. People would be going, what? What is he talking about? That brings us to point six there, which Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed in AD 70. Now this is basically not something I've ever, I mean, sure, somebody probably disputes it out there somewhere because there's always that guy. But the whole world at the time knew about this. They knew about this and it had impacts that were far and wide with this destruction. It was a major catastrophe for the Jews everywhere. There's really nothing in comparison that we could compare it to the total death, I mean, in our experience, to the total destruction of Jerusalem and the temple for the Jews. That was the heart of their culture. It was the heart of their religion. It was gone. The temple that should have lasted forever because it was God's temple was gone. Jerusalem, the holy city, was gone. And the impact on Jews everywhere was huge. I mean, that had ripple effects. Oh, we really can't fully understand it, but it was huge. Gentry points out how this passage just does not fit with an AD 95 writing, saying, if John writes this 25 years after the temple's fall, it would be horribly anachronous. Such requires a suppressed premise of an unmentioned temple rebuilding, while John overlooks the very recent catastrophic destruction of that famous temple he, all Jews, and the rest of the Roman Empire know very well. Next slide, please. Here's the question. Now, this seems pretty clear, right? I think my logic is sound. It's multiple levels. It's a lot of stuff. So how do the late daters justify holding to their position in light of the clear internal evidence of Revelation 11, 1 through 2? How do they justify this? How do they justify this? Go ahead and click it. Contortionist methodology. That's my term. Contortionist methodology. Because they bend it all out and you're like, what? But it's amazing what they do. It's amazing. So go ahead. It's pretty bizarre, really. This, I think, is very interesting. So according to Ewing, referencing an article by J. Christian Wilson, most late-date scholars even admit these verses must have been written before 70. Now you're going, what? So they hold to an AD 95 date, but they think these verses were written before 70? And he says, most late daters. And it's interesting, I brought this book in. I started reading this. It's called Redating the New Testament. It's J.A.T. Robinson. His thesis is basically that the entire New Testament was written before AD 70. And he sets out to show that in this book. It's a fascinating read. Plus, he's got a good sense of humor. And I appreciate that in a, right? You need humor in a topic like this. But he wrote this. He said, it is indeed generally agreed that this passage, and he's talking about 11, 1 through 2 here, that this passage must bespeak a pre-70 situation. But the solution has been to date the oracle or oracles of chapter 11, like that of chapter 12, he's referring to some other stuff there, earlier than the book as a whole, and to see them as originally Jewish rather than Christian. Basically, they're saying this was written before the book itself was written. It was brought into, it was another source. Another source provided, it was brought into and plugged in here by whoever it was that wrote it. John, ancient John. That was something that he said. So,
did they explain why he would do it?
Well, it's called source criticism.
What does that
mean? Source criticism. Yeah. What does that mean? Good question. This means basically they seek to figure out how Revelation, and this is actually something people do, and you'll see this in a lot of scholarly stuff, how Revelation came into being by speculating on the use of different sources being brought together to make the book. This is a scholarship out there. Sources brought together to make a book. In other words, maybe they took a little bit from this author over here, you know, maybe this point of view over here, kind of bringing in different times of writing. Let's put it all together into one whole to make this work. And this is perhaps combined with redaction criticism, those particular methods, which looks at the motivation of the editor. So John would now be an editor. I guess there are inspired editors. There, you know, we have 1st and 2nd Chronicles, 1st and 2nd Kings, and those were clearly written later, and a lot of materials brought together. We have Luke, who in a lot of ways, he went and interviewed people, and he put it together and wrote the book. But that's not what Revelation claims to be now, is it? Revelation doesn't claim to be that. Ewing, he points out concerning this, he says, Collins, and that's Adela Yarbrough Collins, she goes so far as to attribute the downfall of the early date to the rise of source critical methods, which gave many scholars a way out, so to speak, of this compelling argument. So basically, if you just say, oh, well, the book was written in 1895, but that particular part was written, obviously, before, you know, the fall of Jerusalem. He just kind of incorporated it into his writing. It's kind of what they're saying. The retort, therefore, has been to concede the pre-70 writing of 11:1-2, but to then speculate that these verses are simply being incorporated by the Domitian era author from earlier material. What did I call that? Contortionist methodology. What was that, Jeff?
I was thinking something else.
Yeah, I'm sure you were. I'm sure you were. So next slide there, please. Do y'all see any problems with that? Do you see any problems with that?
Yeah, the scripture said otherwise.
Well, there are examples in the scriptures of things being compiled and put together. I just pointed out a few of them. But that's not how this represents. So what does this represent? How does Revelation represent itself?
It's a letter to the seven churches.
A letter to seven churches. Is it written to be a unified communication? Does it proclaim itself to be a collection of sources to then use as, or it's written as what?
The word of the Lord from an angel.
Yes, that was given to John. Here, write this. Write this. Here's the message. Here's the message.
And if he needs this, anybody that adds to or takes away from this, pretty much begin.
It does say that. It does say that. And maybe we'll get to that verse when we get to, we'll get to the end of the book. Sir? Sir? What? Is that not something I want to hear? Okay, all right, so. Anyway, Revelation does not represent itself as a piecemeal collection of sources put together in one book. And it just doesn't. And it destroys the continuity, and it's forced. They're forcing these two verses to fit their paradigm of when the book was written. Which, as I, Lord willing, would continue to go on here, I'll show you how that paradigm is built on really shifty sand. It's just not strong at all. And thus, it seems that they put higher weight, and along those lines, what I was just saying, on the much debated, inconclusive tradition of one statement of Irenaeus. One statement by this man over the self-witness and the unity of the book of Revelation. And Lord willing, we will get to Irenaeus down the road. I really want to present that to you because, you know, you read these guys and they say, everybody agreed with this. All the fathers, everybody agreed with this. No, actually, when you look at it, not everybody did. In fact, if you look at historically how they got to the late date and why, you know, it's interesting in the 19th century, most scholars held to an early date. It was in the 20th century that people started changing, and there were three commentaries that came on Revelation that came out at the beginning of the 20th century. And all three of them held a late date. They held a late date. And all three of them pointed to the same guy who had made an argument for a late date, and even that was a weak argument, but they grabbed it, and because these three influential commentaries started saying there's a late date, everybody picked up on that, and then people started trying to prove it and justify it and so on and so forth, and now everybody's saying, well, everybody thinks it's a late date. I read this quote to you out of Robinson earlier. Hopefully I can find it again. It's awesome what he says as far as a problem of a lot of the dating that goes on. Anyway, I thought I'd marked it. It has to do with assumptions. Basically, assumptions can build on each other without being verified, and people just, they build on other people's assumptions, and it just kind of, eventually they're saying, well, everybody thinks this, but it's all built on assumptions or on one guy's opinion, which in a lot of ways, that's what's going on here. I mean, that's, we'll go into this more detail later, just throwing that out there, because we have to ask the question, why are these people, why are they doing this? Because it just seems so clear. It seems so clear. Ewing, he says this, for such a source criticism model, it makes you wonder why there was no effort on the part of whoever the editors of Revelation might be, as Ewing puts it, to account for the inclusion of such obsolete material without any updating. So you would think about it. If they actually took material that was written before AD 70, and you're writing in AD 95, and you're incorporating it into your work, why would you not kind of adjust it a little bit so it fit with everything else you're saying? They didn't do that. It doesn't seem to make sense.
Either, really, I mean, if you look at the rest of the book as a future prophecy, what does it accomplish by going back and adding something that already happened?
I done. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Well, if you look at most, like the higher criticisms and what you would get taught in college, at least at a non-Christian college, maybe it was some Christian college. But most of them say like all of the New Testament wasn't written in the first century; it was probably the second century. Before all that stuff got written, and it was obviously a fraud.
Well, that's what one thing that Robison really addresses. He shows the different sketches and when people thought. I mean, here he's got 2 Peter written between 160 and 175 that some people are saying. I'm like, really? Yeah. Or James was written 120 to 140.
There seems to be just at the root of it all, higher criticism, and it's just the heart of unbelief.
Unbelief.
I don't want to believe this, so I'm going to come up with some way to discredit it.
Well, the source criticism thing, we were taught in the Old Testament survey that the Torah was not written by Moses. It was a compilation of material from various sources, and they had letters for the sources.
And that was at Huntington.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, you run into that when you do any studying of the Pentateuch. You're definitely going to be running into that. And any commentary you read, you need to know what that's about and why you don't. Why you disagree with it and to be able to engage it. Otherwise, they're going to say a lot of things. You're going to be like, huh? And that's kind of stuff that they bring the stuff into that most lay people are going to not understand at all, which is going to require, like, you had to take a course to teach you what that was so you could even understand what it was talking about, just to even be able to read it and try to see what they're telling you to understand what you're reading in the Bible.
Well, I think
it's a lot of hurdles to jump through.
Ways to justify why you don't have to believe all the Bible's being worked out.
In a lot of cases it is. But here's the thing. We've got a lot of very strong, I believe, truly Christian men and women who write commentaries and write things on Revelation, but they hold to a later date. And maybe I'll show you in a little bit. I mean, there's just one guy, respected commentator, and I was wanting to know why he held to a late date because I was so disappointed in him. I really was. I was disappointed. I mean, I've told you that before. I read this and I expect more out of them. And so I'm reading his thing and basically said, well, the early date evidence is very strong, but I just can't get past the Irenaeus passage. And so I'm going to keep to a late date. I'm sitting there going, really? You're going to hold to the Irenaeus passage over all this other strong evidence? And it's because they always say, well, everybody else is holding to a late date, so that must be right. I'm like, come on, man, peer pressure? Really? But, one thing I've seen lately is there's a lot of people who are moving back to an earlier date. And I will say that Gentry's book, Before Jerusalem Fell, has been huge in that. Huge in that. And there are a lot of people that hold to a late date. They're going, this early date evidence is very strong. I need to reevaluate what my stuff is. That's you pick up on little things here and there that seem to do that. So this is something in discussion. Because what I tell you, 19th century, most scholars held to a early date. 20th century, everybody shifted to a late date. maybe in the 21st century we'll move back to an early date. And that's nuts, but so is scholarship through the centuries. Next one there. Questions? Any questions? Any questions? That's not it for now. That's okay. There you go. Thank you, Mark. All right, so conclusion. Those who insist on a late date interpretation end up all over the place. I think I've shown you that with, if y'all need one of these summary sheets, on the various interpretive models that we've used. Which is the only one that starts with an early date? Preterist or partial preterist. The only ones. So, for those who insist on the late date, they have no way to tie the prophecy to Revelation 11 to actual reality unless they do some mind-bending methodology, some contortionist methodology. And thus they are left to imaginary speculation of the future. What do we call those guys? Futurists. Trying to see how it symbolically ties into some other thing in history. What do we call those guys?
Historicists.
Or spiritualizing it. What are those guys? Idealists. So questions now. None? No comments? No thoughts? Was that pretty straightforward? What do y'all think about that?
I think the reason to put that prophecy in there about Drew, me, would be to give credibility to the readers. This is going to happen pretty quick, and they would see it.
I think that's a really, really good point. And grounded in history. Because writing this, the original readers would have known the temple in Jerusalem were there. And then when they saw the temple in Jerusalem destroyed, that would confirm solidly in their minds, the rest of this is true. And what have we said that the thrust of Revelation is? Victory. 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 Our Lord wins. Jesus wins. There you go. Jesus wins. So, hey, look at that. We're done in time. Great.